This is one of my favorite passages. I probably preached 3 or 4 sermons from it. This one's going to be a little different. God showed me some new things that I'm just real excited about. Here's what I know about Jesus. He accepted invitations. He went home to eat with tax collectors. He would be seen in the marketplace with sinners and spend time with them at their invitation. And he accepted the invitation of a Pharisee to come and have a dinner together. Because Jesus understood he came to seek those who were lost, empty, and separated from God by their sin. So he was willing to go to anyone, anywhere. And as you understand the reality of the cross, he was willing to do anything that we might be saved. There was nothing off the table. There was no limitation, no restriction to God's love for us, as clearly seen in the reality of the cross. And so we look back today and realize how much God loved us because of that moment in time when he hung between heaven and earth and died so cruelly and horribly and painfully, gasping for his last breath. That's a love story. But I want to talk about one prior to the cross that has amazing impact on us today. Here's what I know about Jesus. No one is invisible to him. No one. No one. And yet in the culture in which this was written and when this account took place, there were people who were invisible. The Pharisees had people they did not even recognize as being worthy, worthwhile, or even being much of a person. They were ignored and treated as though they did not exist, as though they were invisible. But Jesus never did that. And so, let me read this to you. Then one of the Pharisees, verse 36, invited him to eat with him. He entered the Pharisee's house and reclined at the table. Now they reclined at the table. They didn't have chairs. They simply reclined with their feet away from the table, their head toward the table, usually leaning on one elbow. In the Pharisee's house, she brought, now look at this, a woman in the town who was a sinner. Now that is a label that you had to earn. She was a sinner. When people saw her, they knew who she was. She was recognized by her reputation and her actions as a sinner. More than likely, she was a woman of the street or a prostitute. And so, in looking at this, there was a sinner who found out that Jesus was reclining at the table in the Pharisee's house. That's somewhat of a dilemma for her. So when she heard this and she realized this, she brought an alabaster flask of fragrant oil and stood behind him at his feet, weeping, and began to wash his feet with her tears. She wiped his feet with the hair of her head, kissing them and anointing them with the fragrant oil. Here is a woman who lived in a culture that did not recognize her personhood, her significance, or value. As a matter of fact, the Pharisees would not speak to women in public ever. They would never eat with a woman in public, and they would not touch this woman under any circumstances. And in a matter of fact, in that culture, women were never invited to a banquet. So the men would come, and they would bring their friends in, or whoever they wanted to talk with, and around the banquet table, there would be discussion politically, theologically, financially, and they would talk about the things of life. And so you'd understand the setting. A banquet hall was not like our dining room, okay, where you had 4 walls and a door and you had to come through a door to get to it. It was in an open area. And so people could just wander around your banquet hall. I mean, they just kind of wander around the table. And many people would come to see who's who at the table and what were they talking about today. And so when the word had gone out that Jesus was at the table, people began to come, let's see what he's going to say. What's going to happen today? And this woman had already been familiar with Jesus. Perhaps if you look in the harmony of the Gospels, you're going to find that prior to this event, that Jesus gave the great invitation. Come unto me, all ye that are labor and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Perhaps she heard those words and they stirred her heart. For she was a woman with great burden, with great guilt, with great emptiness. And she heard the invitation, come unto me. And I guess she wondered if he really meant it. I mean, how many times in life have people said things to you they didn't mean? And I'm wondering what she felt and thought. But here's what we know. She'd heard that he was at the table. And so she came to a place that was going to be filled with stress when she showed up. She was invisible to the Pharisees, but not to Jesus. Here we see, first of all, the extravagance of love that has no limits. I wonder the dilemma she faced as she realized she was not really valued by the Pharisee. She was at his table, and here's Jesus talking perhaps about the things of God. And she took a step of courage and humility and actually stepped behind those feet, bowed down on her knees behind those feet, opened a flask of fragrant oil, and poured the oil on his feet. Now, I want you to understand what happened. If you don't get anything else, you need to get this out of the sermon. Here is a woman who is invisible. She's labeled a sinner. No one wants to have anything to do with her, except for self-gratification. And now she comes behind this incredible prophet. And she kneels down. He's not said anything yet. And she touches his feet. Hear what has just happened in this story. Jesus did not rebuke her or reject her. In a culture that said, "Don't you touch me, woman. Don't you touch me. I know who you are. Don't you touch me. Get away from me." Every man around that table would have done that. But Jesus, when she touched his feet, he did not reject her. She had never, ever in all her life felt such love. Such amazing grace that this man, perfect in every way, would allow such a sinner to touch his body. And in that moment of grace, I believe that's when she gave her heart to him. I think she really said what he said was true. "Come unto me, all you that are weary, heavy laden, I'll give you rest. Come unto me. I'll in no wise cast you out." And she touched his feet, and he didn't rebuke her. And she broke open that flask of fragrant oil that would be carried around the neck and would be opened. It would be valued at anywhere from many, many weeks of work. Some would say even up to a year of wages. It was very valuable. It was very precious. It was probably the most significant thing she owned. And she took it and poured it on his feet. We know it's very precious because in the other Gospels, when he talks about another event very similar to this in Bethany, that Judas said, "We should have sold that and gave money to the poor." That wasn't quite what he had in mind. But he knew it was worth a lot of money. It was worth something. It may have been the greatest resource of wealth this woman ever had. And she poured it out on his feet. Oh. Her love had no limits. When he received her, her heart exploded with worship. She had found someone who really cared for her, who received her, who valued her. For the first time in her life, she was not invisible. She now had found significance by the grace of God and the person of Jesus Christ. And she began to explode with amazing worship. She could not help herself. She didn't pour some of it. She poured all of it. She abandoned her wealth, so to speak, as little as it was in the lives of so many, but yet great in her eyes. She poured it on his feet. What extravagance. And yet we live in a time in the 21st century, 2,000 years later, where we're trying to figure out what is the absolute least we can do for God and get his favor. How much can I get by with and still be okay? I mean, I love you, Lord, but you know, it's tough. Lord, I know I love you, but I just, you know. She said, Lord, I can't hold anything back. You got all I got. What extravagant love. What amazing love. That which represented much, much work, she held nothing back. She was captured by his love that day. Nothing can compare to that, as a matter of fact. Captured by his love and his grace. And her extravagant gift was a reflection of a changed heart. That's what happened. And then her love could not be contained. It had to be poured out. Guys, wouldn't it be great if we could get to a point of putting aside our what people think and what people say and how they judge us and say, man, I just want to love you with all my heart, Jesus. I just want to love you with all my heart. I don't care what people say. Because I guarantee you the buzz was around the table about this lady. But that isn't all. She was an unwelcome guest. She'd crashed the party. And here's what we know. The Pharisee was saying, look, in his mind he was thinking, well, this guy ain't no prophet. If he is a real prophet from God, he'd know what kind of woman just touched him. He would know that she's a sinner with a horrible reputation, with much ugliness in her life. Everybody's just using her. Nobody cares her. Nobody loves her. And he would have known that. He would have rebuked her. He would have pushed her away. He would have chastised her. She was an unwelcome guest. He was thinking those things. And Jesus showed he was a prophet by saying, let me ask you a question. If someone owes 50 denarii and 500 denarii and both debts are forgiven, who's going to be the more grateful? And he said, well, the one who got forgiven for the 500. You're right. And Jesus said, you know, this woman has sinned much, and I've forgiven her. And he said, you know, since I've been in your house, she's not stopped washing my feet. You didn't do that. You didn't give me a kiss when I came in, yet she continues to kiss my feet. Then Simon knew, this man knew what I was thinking. Whoa, he might still be a prophet. She was an unwelcome guest. I had an unwelcome guest at my house this week. I did. I know what that's like when somebody's in your house and something's in your house you don't really want there. I was in a meeting with two guys from the GBC. We was talking about some stuff and was winding it up. And they were in my office and I get a call. Rachel says, Tim, Charlene's on line one and there's a snake in the house. Yeah, man. I said, well, that ended the meeting. And so I picked up the phone and said, yeah, what's going on? I said, man, there's a snake in the house. It's a rattlesnake. And the tone of her voice told me that it was somewhat between a six-foot rattler or maybe a cobra or maybe a python. I wasn't sure, but I knew it was probably going to swallow her whole any minute. And I'm thinking, my gosh, so calm down. Okay, where is in the living room. Okay. I'm on the way. And I'm thinking, okay, I hang the phone up, say, guys, thank you for coming. I got to go. I've got Rachel call John Cooper and tell him to get there and see if he can help before I get there. Because I'm thinking, man, she's going to be swallowed by the time I get there. There ain't going to be nothing left. And so I get in the car and I'm driving. I'm saying, you know, what am I going to do? I don't like snakes either. I'm not really like, hey, I'm not looking forward to getting there. First time I ever drove a speed limit in my life. I'm thinking, Lord, I'm praying, dear God, what are you going to do? You know, and so I'm thinking, do I get the gun and shoot it? Well, no, it's in the house. I mean, that'd be bad. And then I'm thinking, what do I do? So I'm trying to think, what can I arm myself with for this incredible beast in my living room? And so I'm thinking, man, I bet that thing's, you know, there's no telling. And when she had rattles, I'm thinking, well, it's probably got six rattlers. I'm going, good gosh, that's bad. And so I finally pull up in the driveway. I go in my tool area and get a shovel and a ball bat. That's the extent of my tools. Anyway, 34-ounce ball bat. It's just, you know, anyway. So I'm moving in there, and I go in the house, and I'm kind of like not sure what's happening, so I'm moving very cautiously. And I said, Charlene, I'm here. And she says, I'm still in here in the living room. I'm going, okay. And so I walk in there, and she has this snake cornered under the table. She has got a broom and beaten the daylights out of it every time it sticks its head out. And I'm thinking, all right. And it's up there by the chimney on the table, and I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, okay, what are we going to do here? And I'm thinking, what am I going to do with things on the table? I ain't sticking my hand in there to get that thing out. So what had happened, the snake did not realize what had happened when she saw it. It was in the middle of the floor, and she thought it was a snake. When she walked in, she was about 6 feet from it, and it reared up and started snapping at her. And she's going, well, I'm going to tell you what, I've raised four children. I ain't going to take that. And she pretty much hemmed that thing up in a corner. And so... we're sitting there thinking, okay, what am I going to do? My shovel's too big. I can't get on the table. The ball bat ain't going to work on the table. Can't get a swing in. And so John Cooper shows up with a hoe. That is the correct tool for snake killing, a hoe. All right? And he comes in with that thing, and he looks, and that you can see he's wrapped up. He's wadded up under the table. And so finally John reaches down there and grabs a hoe and just pulls him out, lays a hoe on top of him. I take that ball bat and lay him out. Man, I just pounded his head, and he went to where dead snakes go when they die. I mean, he ain't coming back. And then John picked up that snake, all 15 inches of it, and carried it outside. It was not a welcome guest. Can I tell you something? This Pharisee felt the same way about that woman. He just assumed somebody killed her than she lived. He despised her. The crowd around the table despised her. All but Jesus. All but Jesus. He wouldn't send her away. He would not rebuke her. He would not chastise her. And here she's weeping over his feet and rubbing his feet with oil and drying it with her hair and kissing his feet. Her devotion, the expression of her devotion reveals a depth of her gratitude. She had found the grace of God and the love of God. Her life had been touched like never before. Incidentally, that's what salvation really is, incidentally. It's not getting a church membership. It's not figuring out how to be a good Baptist. It's finding a relationship and new life in Christ. And she found a new beginning in her life, a new power to live a different way. She was not the same. There was none like it. He let her touch her. Touch him. She expressed her devotion. The table was almost speechless. Look how the story ends. Because here, it did not matter what others thought or said. Her devotion would not be constrained. Her love could not be contained, but her devotion would not be constrained. Man, she just loved this man who loved her first, who invited her to come. And she did. And she was not disappointed. There is a world out there that believes we think they're invisible because of the way we ignore them, reject them, and judge them. But Jesus, to him, no one's invisible. On the cross, he died for everyone if they would just come by faith and receive his grace. So I tell you, you say, well, what happened here? Was she saved because she broke open the flask of oil and it was very expensive? Or was she saved because she rubbed his feet and kissed his feet? No, that wasn't why she was saved. That wasn't how she got a relationship with God. You can't buy your relationship with God. You can't earn a relationship with God. What she had was the experience of grace is a starting place for extravagant love and expressed devotion. The moment he let her touch him, grace flowed to her. Her life was changed. She had come to him, and he did not throw her away. Christ receives sinful people, of which I am chief. I'm so glad he did. And so I see this amazing story unfold. It was not what she owned or what she did that saved her, is what she believed. She believed his message. She received his grace. And she was no longer the same. Her faith was activated toward God, who saw her in her spiritual need. She was not invisible to him, and neither are you. She saw the one who offered her an opportunity for forgiveness and peace with God, as he does for you. Look at how the story ends. Therefore, I tell you, her many sins have been forgiven. Past tense. Said, it's already been a done deal. That's already been taken care of. That's why she loved much. Now, Jesus didn't make a grammatical error. He said, the deal's already been done. Now, but the one who is forgiven little loves little. He was talking about the Pharisee. Then he said to her, your sins are forgiven. You know why he had to say that? Because they had already raised doubt. Man, they already said, this person shouldn't even be in this room. This shouldn't be. She shouldn't be touching this man. Who does she think she is? God does not love her. God cannot change her. She's a sinner. And Jesus said, look, it's already happened, but just so we'll be perfectly clear about this, her sins are forgiven. She said, don't worry about what these people say. And all my ministry, I've heard people say, when I've seen people that were just absolutely pagan and heathen get saved, I've people say, you think they really got saved? Well, yeah, I do. Man, I've told the story, and I'm not going to go through the whole story, but when I had that man show up that had gone through all kind of Christ in life, including a sex change, changing his gender, and when he asked me, can God save me? Man, I'd already prayed over that thing for 3 or 4 days because I knew the question was coming. I had to settle my own heart. I said, yes, sir, the grace of God can save you. Had a man ask me one time, Pastor, I've broken all the Ten Commandments. That's a pretty good list. Can he save me? Can he forgive me? Oh, yes, sir, he can. He can forgive you. I don't care what other people say. He changes lives. Does it all the time. How much sin must a person commit to be a sinner? Just one. And you need a Savior. This woman valued the relationship with God over the rituals of the religious culture. I hope you have put your faith more than being a Baptist, because that ain't good enough. Or any denomination. You need Jesus. I want to say a word to the parents that stood up here, and to those of you that are parenting and have been a part of a dedication service, and maybe you've got children that are older and growing. I want to say something to you just a moment. Don't let your child's spiritual life be invisible to you. I know we want them to be great athletes, great musicians, great Rhodes Scholars. I know we want them to have a place on the cheerleading squad and do whatever we think is wonderful. That's great. I have no problems with that. But please hear me. It doesn't matter if they can hit a golf ball 300 yards, throw a football 60 yards, hit a baseball 400 feet, or do 10 flips in the air. If they don't know Jesus Christ, they're going to die and go to hell. You cannot afford to let your child's spiritual life be invisible to you. You must give attention to it as you would every other area of their life. And let me say something else. Don't let your spiritual life be invisible to them. They need to see Jesus in you. They need to see the Christian character we talk about and sing about in the home 7 days a week. They need to see your extravagant love for Christ and your expressions of devotion to Him because of your experience of grace. Please, please, don't take that for granted.